This is Houston Matters. I'm Craig Cohen. Good morning. Coming up, your questions for Congresswoman Sylvia Garcia. Also, remembering the late Astros star Ken Caminiti and the steroid confession that changed baseball. Plus, the saga and legal battle over a painting at the Museum of Fine Arts Houston. First, though, as we've been reporting, the first funerals are taking place today for victims of the horrific mass shooting a week ago today at Robb Elementary in Uvalde, in which 21 people were killed, 19 of them children. We now know more about what happened, that police were on the scene a full hour before moving into the classroom where the gunman killed all those people. We know the names and faces of the victims, and we know that it did not take long for the political world to entrench in their usual positions on why such school shootings happen and what should be done about it. Many Democrats say guns are the key to gun violence and call for what they see as reasonable restrictions like background checks, perhaps raising the age to acquire assault-style weapons. Many Republicans, including those who spoke at last weekend's NRA meeting here in Houston, want the focus to be on mental health and tighter security at schools, from limiting entrances and exits to more armed security on campuses. Governor Abbott has not ruled out calling a special session, but even if he does, what might we expect from state lawmakers? And what should we expect from Congress, where there does not appear to be anything of any substance that could meet a filibuster-proof majority in the U.S. Senate? Let's discuss now with University of Houston political analysts Nancy Sims and Brandon Roddinghouse. Nancy, Brandon, good morning.
Morning, Greg.
Good morning.
Brandon, let me start with you, and let's begin with what state politicians have had to say over the last week. What have we heard from Governor Abbott, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, and state lawmakers?
Yeah, obviously Governor Abbott has taken some flack for his response to this. As you noted, in the last few days, the NRA's convention effectively highlighted the opposition to gun reform. Well, I think the thing that stood the most out to me was that Governor Abbott appeared almost simultaneously in video at the NRA conference and in person in Uvalde. So there's definitely a kind of disconnect between what politicians are saying and then what might end up happening. As you noted, trying to find consensus on this is going to be a real challenge, especially in an election year. So the politicians so far have been, I think, fairly muted or non-committal, and we'll see what the next days lead up to.
Nancy, is it notable that a number of folks slated to speak at the NRA convention in Houston this weekend ultimately backed out?
I don't think it's that notable. I think, you know, for example, Abbott backed out, but sent a video. I think it was out of respect more than anything, but I don't think their voices were very different. What we have here is your classic Texas two-step, saying one thing out of, to one audience and another to another audience. So it's, in my opinion, we're not going to see a whole lot of outcomes from this.
Yeah, Brandon, what precisely did Governor Abbott say to the NRA, and what did he say to folks in Uvalde?
Well, in effect, he said to the NRA that there are still a lot of laws on the books that would prevent something like this from happening, or rather that would punish something like this from happening. In Uvalde, he was addressed the problem, but was noncommittal about exactly what that would be. He said changes would be made to the law, he says, across several subject areas. Exactly what he means is unclear. Trying to find some consensus here is going to be a real burden in an election year. But obviously, as governor, he's got the power to be able to call the ledge back and have a special session on this. Whether he will or not will depend a lot on how much traction the issue continues to get. Because we've seen examples in the past where the issue fades pretty quickly. This is obviously unique and different and especially horrible, but it doesn't mean that we're going to see a lot of change.
Nancy, Governor Abbott's opponent, Beto O'Rourke, crashed the governor's news conference in Uvalde the day after the shooting to call out the governor's inaction after other school shootings. Was that move by O'Rourke, in your view, a way to articulate the views of many Texans, as we heard some suggest last week, or was it, as some on the stage with the governor suggested in the moment, a grandstanding stunt? Or can it be both?
I think it can be both. I know I was actually watching that press conference, and I was initially appalled, but I didn't recognize it as Beto from the angle that I saw. And then when I did learn it was him, I was even further concerned. But I appear to have been in the minority. A lot of people were proud of him for doing that. And really, this shooting is probably the best thing that's happened to his campaign, and he's taking full advantage of that.
That's a rather shocking sentence to say. I mean, I know you don't mean it necessarily to be so blunt, but
I don't mean it to be cold, but you know, he sees a vulnerability in Abbott over this that he's going to take full advantage of. And in fairness, he's from El Paso, where they had the big shooting there, and he's been on banning assault rifles and other versions of gun legislation, restrictive gun legislation, for years. So it's a boost from that angle.
Brandon, meantime, President Biden visited Uvalde over the weekend. Is there anything he can do without Congress to address the proliferation of school shootings and other incidents of gun violence?
Yes, there have been some things that the White House has done. In fact, just before the shooting took place via unilateral order, but it's a challenge to be able to get these sort of codified into law. Now, Chuck Schumer has moved forward on trying to bypass committee discussion for a couple of bills, so-called gun show loophole, and also the Charleston loophole in terms of existing background checks. There's a group of bipartisan senators who are working on the issue. So it could be that the president has got some ability to be able to navigate this with some of those representatives, but it's still tough. The best thing he can do right now is to be the healer in chief, and he's good at that. His empathy is obviously really strong. He's been in this position before, having lost family members, so he understands this. And I think as he does that, he can keep the political pressure on Congress to do something. And at this point, that's as much as he can really do.
Brandon, you mentioned a couple of loopholes. Can you explain them?
Well, effectively what happens is basically if there's a gun sale between two private individuals, there's a background check that has to be done, and the FBI has a limited time to do that. So the proposal might be to increase that timing. It also may, in fact, shut those down in a more direct way and have it organized in a different process. So the idea is basically to ensure that people who are mentally disturbed may not be able to get these firearms. And although it may not have been exactly the situation that we're confronting in Uvalde, it's still the case that this has been a common occurrence. And so I think Congress is thinking big here and trying to make a bold change. But as I said, politically, that's a tough thing to do, because getting consensus on a bold change, even after a tragedy like this, is still really hard.
Yeah, Nancy, we're about to talk with Houston area Congresswoman Sylvia Garcia. And while she's in the U.S. House, which holds a Democratic majority, which has tried in the past and could again seek to pass some proposed legislation to address gun violence in schools in particular, nothing the House has proposed has gotten the support of a filibuster-proof 60-vote majority in the Senate. So should we expect anything at all to come out of Congress?
I don't know. There seems to be talk among some senators that they feel they could possibly get going on a red flag background check. But again, I'm with Brandon that as the days fade, we're heading into summer. There'll be summer recess. I don't think we're going to see a lot of action at the moment.
Brandon, what do you think? Anything coming out of Congress as a result of this?
I guess I am eternally optimistic with the hope that things move, especially after the violent images come out of Uvalde. But I think I agree with Nancy that it's just such a tough thing to do politically right now. I mean, we're months away from an election. You've got these global political forces that divide us, that makes it really hard for people to come together. It's really going to come down, honestly, to a handful of senators who see a potential problem here. So I think that there's a slim chance we might see modest changes, but I think there's very little chance we'll see any kind of big changes.
We are awaiting the Congresswoman to join us. Nancy and Brandon, can you hang on the line for potentially a few more minutes while we get her connected? Excellent. We're talking with Nancy Sims, analyst and lecturer in the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. That's where Brandon Rodinghouse is a professor of political science. We'll continue our discussion as Houston Matters continues. This is Houston Matters. I'm Craig Cohen. A week after the school shooting in Uvalde, we are discussing the potential for any proposed legislation coming out of Congress or from state lawmakers as well. We're talking with University of Houston political analysts Nancy Sims and Brandon Rottinghaus. And in a few minutes, we'll be joined by Houston area Congresswoman Sylvia Garcia. Nancy and Brandon, we've had a couple of emails come in. I want to share some of the thoughts that we've heard so far. Richard writes, Second Amendment supporters need to realize that gun ownership works both ways. Yes, we have the right to defend ourselves, but that right ends when we take the law into our own hands. Brandon, is there any way for lawmakers to codify that, or is that already the case?
They've treated it as though it's the case, and the Supreme Court has largely followed suit on that. So I do think that that he has a point about the balance here. And I think that the way that the gun laws have been stymied, or changes to gun laws have been stymied, has in part been because you've got such powerful opposition to big changes. And so the NRA has changed the politics around this, partly by lobbying and the kind of things that all lobbying organizations do, but also partly by changing the culture around gun ownership. And now we see a big divide between, you know, politically gun owners and non-gun owners. So that divide is now a kind of cultural phenomenon as much as a political one. So those things are really reinforcing each other. So I think the problem is trying to find consensus in terms of how we draw these lines with rights and responsibilities is really a challenge.
Nancy Mario writes, gun owners have always claimed to be law-abiding citizens, so let's hold them to that truth in all aspects of the law. He says anyone convicted of even a misdemeanor would not be allowed, this is his idea, to possess a weapon outside their home, that it would be a felony if they did, and they would have a revoke alert tied to their driver's license, but be able to petition for reinstatement immediately after the infraction, and as part of the process would undergo a comprehensive background check, mental evaluation, and registration of all firearms they possess. Would something like that fly?
Well, it's very good and it's a thoughtful idea. I can't see the legislature or the federal Congress going in that direction, but it's a very thoughtful idea and I like it. You know, I do think there are a few areas where Americans agree in large numbers. One is background checks, particularly red flags, like how you can be on the no-fly list, but you can still buy a gun. I think you'll find that a majority of Americans tend to agree with that. And then, you know, we've had off and on an assault weapons ban. And, you know, the idea, again, what does an average 18-year-old need with a AK-47 is a question that's fair. You know, and I think you'll find a lot of certainly urban Americans question the assault rifle purchases. So, you know, there are paths which governing bodies could take that we just don't see action occurring.
Yeah, Brandon, it does seem that there are, for all the entrenchment in Congress, in state politics, there does seem to be some things that nearly every poll you read, there are majorities in favor of this action, that action, some of the examples that Nancy just cited. And yet, it does not seem to translate to action in Congress or in Austin. Why do you think there is that disconnect?
I think that partially it's about just the resistance to making changes, especially among Republicans, and they're fearful about the impact. And it's not so much that I think that they're fearful for what might happen as a result of the laws, but what might happen as a result of these changes politically for them. So some of it is just worry about what their coalition might want. So Republicans have got a pretty tin ear on this. In fact, polling from the Texas Tribune found that 62% of Republicans approved of the way lawmakers handled gun violence after the 2021 legislative session, where they effectively allowed for there to be open carry. And so these things are hard to maneuver around. Once you've got them politically hardened, it's a real challenge to be able to make those changes.
Yeah, Nancy, debate surrounding gun laws and surrounding school safety tend to be, understandably so, very emotional in the immediate aftermath of a school shooting. But do we tend to see, and obviously the lawmakers in Austin, they're only in session if called to a special session or then once every 2 years for 6 months. But aside from that, Congress is essentially in session year round. Do we tend to see a sort of slow playing, a sense of, well, let's get past this immediate emotional response and then sit down and have a discussion and maybe that things do kind of trail off, as Brandon suggested earlier?
Yeah, I think there's always a lot of talk initially. And as long as there's national media coverage making this the top story, you'll see ideas being put forth and lots of grandstanding from, you know, elected officials. But once the media crews go away, the ideas die down. I don't think we'll have a special session in Texas. And I think I just want to say Brandon and I balance each other out beautifully. Brandon being the optimist, me being the pessimist or the cynic, as the case may be. But I don't have any faith that we're going to see any action in Texas at all. Even Governor Abbott, you know, the first day or two was talking about mental health, and this is the issue in mental health. But the fact is that, you know, the last legislative session slashed mental health dramatically, mental health funding. So, you know, unless he's going to call a special and restore mental health funding, I can't see what else they would do.
We've been talking with University of Houston political analysts Nancy Sims and Brandon Rodinghaus, and now we are joined by Houston area Congresswoman Sylvia Garcia. Congresswoman Garcia, good morning. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. How are y'all this morning?
All right.
Day after Memorial Day.
So we have been talking, Congresswoman, about, of course, the ghastly school shooting a week ago in Uvalde and the response to it. What, if any, steps would you like to see Congress take to reduce the number of mass shootings, school shootings included?
Well, it's, you know, the time for prayers and thoughts for family are just getting really, really stale in those words. I think people want action. You know, Uvalde's soul has been crushed, their hearts are aching, and they're just asking, what will Congress do? So we've got to act, and I sit on the Judiciary Committee. We are pulling things together to have a hearing on Thursday. It is going to cover probably everything that people have been talking about: background checks, raising the age, some storage laws, banning ghost guns, closing the loophole on bump stocks, and the red flag law. So everything will be probably in one bill. It's not been decided yet. And we'll get it done, and then we'll have to work twice and five times harder to get the attention of the Senate, because it's usually just more difficult to get things done in the Senate. But I'm confident that the House will act and will act quickly next week.
That said, I mean, I don't know how else to underscore this. To get anything past a filibuster-proof majority in the U.S. Senate seems highly unlikely. It doesn't seem that Congress was inclined to do much of anything after the many, many past school shootings that seem only to happen on this scale here in America. What will it take to convince 60 U.S. senators to do any of the things that you just described?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, we keep talking Congress, but let's be clear. The House has passed background checks before. We passed it last year. The bill is over there. We will pass a bill that will address all of these things. And the American people just need to raise their voices loud and clear. More than the majority of Americans, I think it's as high as 80%. Want background checks. A majority of Americans want a red flag law. Majority of Americans want to raise the age. They need to contact their senators. They need to contact Mitch McConnell. They need to contact Chuck Schumer and say, enough is enough. We must move forward and do what we can to save our children, to protect our children. No child should have fear in their eyes when they walk into a school. You know, we have promised a lot of freedoms in this country, and we owe it to our children to give them the freedom from fear. And the parents, the freedom from fear. It is just almost crazy that we don't get something done. So it's time to act. We need to let the senators know that enough is enough.
Congresswoman, we have an email from Elizabeth who wanted to speak about the assault weapons ban, which, of course, was in effect from 1994 to 2004 and then expired. She asks, how much did mass shootings increase? How many of those shootings used AR-15s? Can you speak to that?
I don't have the number in front of me, but we know there has been a significant increase. I think almost all of our most recent mass shootings have involved an automatic weapon. I think that's why we are really pushing. And I know I sit on the gun violence task force. I kept pushing. We must include raising the age. I mean, the idea that this young man had a birthday one day and the next day went and bought one AR-15 and then a couple of days later went and bought another one. If he'd walked into a liquor store to buy a bottle of wine or a bottle of beer, he would have been carded. They would have let him do it. So we make it easier for people to get guns. And you know, that's on the governor in the legislature. I mean, the governor signed 22 measures last time, loosening restrictions, everything from no need to get a license to being able to carry anything you want to. And it's just crazy that at 18, you can buy a rifle or a long gun, which includes the AR-15. But you got to be 21 to get a handgun. It should all be the same 21. So we'll make that change, and it has increased. And I am all for reinstating the assault weapons ban. Unfortunately, you know, I don't know that's going to get on the bill that we're going to do, because even among the Democratic conference, there are some that do not favor that. So we've got to make sure that we can get all the votes lined up on our side of the aisle to get it out of the House before we can even send it to the Senate. But then therein will lie the problem. The Senate probably will not move on the assault weapons ban.
Congresswoman, I know your time is limited this morning. Before we let you go, we are anticipating the Supreme Court's official decision that could overturn Roe v. Wade within the coming weeks. Last week, Oklahoma's governor signed into law the nation's strictest abortion ban, though Texas, of course, is not really far from it. Do you see any sign that Congress will act on abortion rights in any way prior to or even after the high court's ruling?
Well, we will work to make a Roe v. Wade the law of the land, put it in statute so that we will not have to go through this again. We've already done that in the House, but again, it's stuck in the Senate. We will renew all our efforts because that is a right of privacy that is a constitutional issue, and I don't think that we should stand for it. However, right now, all our energies and focus are on, you know, we're having our emergency meeting of judiciary this week, this Thursday, to take up the gun bills. And then we will be voting on them next week as soon as we get back. So we're focused on the urgency at hand. But obviously, as soon as the decision comes down, and if it is what the leaked opinion looks to be, then we'll have to act and act quickly.
Houston area Congresswoman Sylvia Garcia, she represents the Texas 29th District in the U.S. House. Congresswoman, thank you very much.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Just ahead, remembering the late Astro star Ken Caminiti and the steroids confession that changed baseball forever as Houston Matters continues. This is Houston Matters. I'm Craig Cohen. Ken Caminiti spent 15 seasons in Major League Baseball, most of them with the Houston Astros. He was a three-time All-Star and a one-time MVP. But Caminiti, who died when he was just 41, is remembered as much today for off-the-field challenges, including substance abuse, run-ins with the law, and his admitted steroid use. His complicated life, that admission, its effect on the game, and his untimely death are the subject of a new book by journalist Dan Good. It's called Playing Through the Pain, Ken Caminiti and the Steroids Confession That Changed Baseball Forever. Good tells Houston Matters' Michael Haggerty why Caminiti, the player and the person, fascinates him.
He was a gritty, all-out kind of player. He was always playing with a dirty uniform. He was, you know, he played third base, and he was a switch hitter. And at third base, he was just diving all over the place. He had a cannon for an arm. He'd just throw the ball across the diamond. And he was really great playing third base. He was a three-time Gold Glove winner, a three-time All-Star. You know, he had a really interesting career. And after his career ended, he came forward in Sports Illustrated in 2002 and talked about his use of steroids, which really kind of blew open the lid on Major League Baseball steroids problem. And, you know, I think it overshadowed Ken's career in some ways. And, he died tragically 2 years after that. And, you know, I just think it's a good chance for us to look back at the guy he was, look back at the player he was, at the person he was, and, you know, really reflect on the life he lived.
Let's talk a little bit more about the player then. You said he was a gritty guy, always playing dirty. Toughness was a big part of his reputation. What are some stories that kind of illustrate that?
You know, he was always getting hurt. He was always banged up. When he was growing up, he wanted to be a football player. Football was his favorite sport to play because he loved the collisions. And you saw that as he rose through baseball from, you know, his high school days to his college days to his pro days. You know, he actually separated his shoulder in 1984 during a college game, and he came back really quickly, and it took him a little while to heat up again. He ended up, having a really great season, and he toured on Team USA with Mark McGwire and Barry Larkin and all these other players ahead of the Olympic Games, but he was cut, and he was actually drafted that summer by the Astros in the third round. And ended up rising through the minor league system with the Astros. And he made his debut in 1987. He had a really great debut. He actually won Player of the Week his first week in the major leagues. He had a great debut game. He had a home run and a triple. And, you know, he just had an awesome game. And, kind of went from there. But he had his ups and downs and his struggles. And he was with the Astros until 1994, until the strike. You know, it was him, Craig Biggio, and Jeff Bagwell together. They were like the three young guys who were leading the Astros forward. And that 1994 team was poised to make the playoffs before the strike happened. But then, you know, the strike happened and the season was over. The season was finished in August and the team looked to shed salary. And Ken's salary was right at the top of the team in terms of the amount of money. And they wanted to shed his salary from the payroll. So they traded him to the Padres. And while he was with the Padres, he became a huge star. He played 4 years for the Padres, MVP award, Gold Gloves, All-Stars, you name it. He helped the team get to the World Series in 1998. And after that World Series, he actually came back to Houston to play with the Astros again. And he played with the Astros in 99 and 2000. Had some off-the-field struggles that second time. He had off-the-field struggles the first time too, but they were more pronounced the second time. And by 2001, it was his last season. But he was just, you know, it was neat talking to players about him. He was an awesome competitor. Guys loved playing against him or with him because he forced them to raise their level of play. You know, you played with or against him, and you wanted to play the best you could. And, you know, that kind of carried every single place he went, every single place he played. You know, he had a scowl about him. You know, if he was really intense, he was intense, and he had this scowl about him. And players would feel intimidated just by his scowl. Like, he didn't need to say a word. It was just, you know, he had the goatee, and, you know, he was, you know, just really intimidating. He was kind of a teddy bear internally, but, you know, players were intimidated by him, and he really motivated players to play their best. And, you know, there was a lot of love from his teammates and his coaches, the people who played with him. They adored playing with him.
So you mentioned Ken Caminiti's substance abuse problem and his legal troubles, a lot of which occurred here in Houston. How did it substance abuse problem get started, and what kinds of things did he struggle with?
This was something he struggled with throughout his life. He struggled with this from his childhood on forward. Growing up in San Jose, California, you know, drugs and alcohol were easily accessible. They were always around, and the people around him were doing things. You know, and I think that looking back at his life, a lot of his addiction issues were fueled by the fact that he had suffered childhood trauma when he was a kid. And, you know, he used drugs and alcohol as a way to dull the pain, to blur the pain, to get through the day. And, you know, he really struggled with that. And, you know, when you're in your 20s and when you're, you know, running hard, even in college, you know, as a minor leaguer, it wasn't raising as many red flags. Like, certainly people noticed and said, hey, this guy's, you know, pretty wild. And, you know, and he's out late at night and we can't really count always for what he's doing, but he shows up and plays and he's accountable on that way. You know, so I think for a while, it was just kind of, this is who he is. You know, he has that partying streak in him, you know, but, you know, as you get to your later 20s, your early 30s, a lot of other people around him were slowing down. They start a family. They're in a different place in their life, and he's still going hard. And that's, I think, where a lot of the people around him were really concerned, whether that's on the Astros and then later on the Padres. You know, but you had Astros personnel like Art Howe who were, you know, reaching out to him like, hey, you know, maybe you can go get some help, and we can just say you went on the DL for an injury, and you can come back and, you know, play when you're ready. Like, you know, the front office, his teammates would approach him and just say, hey, how are you doing? You know, we know you're struggling. And, you know, I think part of the problem is the baseball culture, the baseball lifestyle that he was a part of encourages that, encourages substances. And that could be something as simple as having a beer to come down after a game. You know, one beer turns into six beers, turns into whatever. But then it's the up and down. It's the up and down of, you know, Ken was taking other substances to stay on the field, such as painkillers. And he was also taking greenies to keep himself up. So it was the greenies, the painkillers, and then it was coming down after the game. And it's this up and down. And, you know, cocaine was a factor as well. And, you know, it was difficult unpeeling all the layers of his substance abuse and recognizing. And a lot of times there were really good points in his career. There were clean points in his life. You know, 1993, he went to rehab for the first time. And he was really devoted to it and did a great job of staying sober and going to AA meetings and surrounding himself with good people. And, you know, you look at that 1994 season again, it was his first All-Star appearance. You know, he's hanging out with Andy Stankiewicz, who was a clean ball player on the Astros. You know, and it was really good. He had a good accountability system, we'll say, around him. And that kind of continued into his Padres years. So when he had these great successes, a lot of times they were a reflection of the people he was surrounding himself with, as well as other things. But, you know, it's tough because in a baseball team, the roster is always changing. People are coming and going. You know, so some of the people who are looking out for him and doing their best to keep him on track aren't always around. And then you have other people around who might be fueling his addictions further and actually being a negative detriment to him. So it's that up and down. And, you know, substance abuse was an undercurrent throughout his career. And, you know, by the end of his career, it was a real problem for him. So he had actually left the Astros early in 2000 and went to get help. And then in 2001, soon after the season was over, he was arrested in that Houston hotel room. And that was really the end of his career. Like, that was it. There was no team that was going to sign him again. You know, there was too much liability, too much baggage.
This is Houston Matters. I'm Michael Haggerty. I'm talking with Dan Good. He's the author of a book about the late former Houston Astro, Ken Caminiti. It's called Playing Through the Pain, Ken Caminiti and the Steroids Confession That Changed Baseball Forever. So in addition to his substance abuse, there's also steroids. He played in what we now know, of course, in hindsight, as the steroid era, when some of baseball's most hallowed records, home run records, fell. And after he was done playing, as you mentioned, he admitted that he'd used steroids, including during that MVP season of 1996. Why did he come clean about it and in the way that he did?
It's a good question. And there's a lot of reasons why. You know, one of them, he's fresh from rehab and looking at, you know, not hiding anymore, not keeping secrets hidden away. You know, I think he also wanted to find a way back into the game. And he felt like, you know, being open and honest and recognizing his struggles and getting that redemption piece, I think would have gone a long way to getting him back in the game. Someone would have taken a chance on him. And in fact, you know, even as he found himself in legal trouble in the years ahead, there were people on different teams who were reaching out to him, including the Padres, saying, hey, you know, maybe you can come to spring training and help us. He had other people on other teams saying, you know, if there's anything we can do. So I think he was sending a lifeline to baseball and to people he connected with in the game saying, hey, I'm here. Like, I'm interested in being a part of this. I don't obviously think that he figured that everything would blow up the way it did. I mean, this story was huge. It was massive. The interesting thing about it is that, you know, people have taken Ken's admissions as 100% truth. Like, there were so many half-truths and shades of gray to his interview. You know, he was giving quotes that protected a lot of people. The core truths of it were there. I mean, he was using steroids. They did help him win the MVP. You know, he went from an all-star to a superstar overnight because of steroids, in large part. And then there was other elements that didn't line up as well in the research I've done, the interviews I've conducted. You know, so there were obviously these half-truths in this story that have proliferated for the last 20 years. But it was so interesting seeing him come forward unflinchingly, say, yes, it helped me. You know, he's one of the few guys who have ever done that.
And he died before this happened, but the Mitchell report and the testimony and conversation about steroids when it really took off, and the sluggers like Mark McGuire and Sammy Sosa appearing before Congress, and all that happened after he died. But his story was cited in the Mitchell report and his confession. I mean, what role did he have in changing baseball and the steroids, ending the steroids era as we know it? How is he, what effect has he had lingering all these years later on baseball?
I think he's had a big effect. You know, his admission triggered congressional conversations that triggered the testing protocols. It was a blind testing protocol in 2003 that stipulated that if a certain number of players tested positive blindly, that they would initiate more testing, deeper testing. And the players hit that threshold and passed it. Like, obviously, they were still using steroids. It didn't stop anything. And some of them did switch to human growth hormone, which wasn't, it couldn't be tested for, at least for the tests that they were doing at the time. But enough players tested positive for different drugs that they had to initiate new rounds of testing. So that mechanism was in place in large part because of Ken's admission. That was really the instigation there. And then, you know, I think his story and his death kind of hung over those congressional hearings, the ones with McGuire, Sosa, and the other players. If he had still been alive, I think he probably would have been called to testify because of what he'd done and what he'd said. And Jose Canseco was there but didn't say much. You know, and then, yeah, the Mitchell report was huge. I mean, I think that it was a byproduct that led to all these other things. And I think that every time that something else happened, it was a callback to Ken's admission. And Ken's admission filled in a lot of gaps, and it brought a lot of attention but focus to the fact that there was a real problem. You know, and I think in a way that his death also forced people to confront it a little bit more. You know, it's tough to say what role steroids played in his health issues and death. Obviously, he was doing street drugs, so there was a different situation there. But, you know, I think people tie all those things together and say he was using steroids and he passed away and it's this tragic thing. And, you know, let's clean this up now. And I think it was a wake-up call in that sense. But, you know, you read the Mitchell report and, you know, his story is all over that.
Dan Good talking with our Michael Haggerty. Good is the author of Playing Through the Pain, Ken Caminiti and the Steroids Confession That Changed Baseball Forever. Still to come, a painting at the Museum of Fine Arts Houston may or may have not been sold under duress to Hitler's art dealer. The saga and the legal battle as Houston Matters continues. Hitler's art dealer. Those three words help explain why there's been a now decades-long challenge over the ownership of a painting in the Museum of Fine Arts Houston's collection. Here's the story. The painting in question is called Marketplace at Perna. It's by an Italian artist, Bernardo Bellotto, who painted it back in 1764. All right, fast forward to 1938. The painting's owner is a Jewish businessman from Switzerland named Max Emden. He sells the work to Karl Haberstock, Nazi leader Adolf Hitler's art dealer. Near the end of World War II, it's among works recovered by the Monuments Men, American and European art historians, curators, and librarians who sought to recover art stolen by the Nazis and return it to the rightful owners. But this painting doesn't go back to Emden due, it would seem, to a clerical error. It ends up in the hands of another art dealer and eventually is gifted to MFAH. The main question that courts and commissions have tried to settle in the decades since is whether, as Emden's grandchildren claim, Emden sold it to the Nazis in the first place under duress. The museum has long maintained it acquired the painting legally and that it has documentation proving Emden sold it voluntarily. Just this month, a federal court granted the museum's motion to dismiss a lawsuit brought by Emden's heirs. In other words, the museum can keep the painting. But some, like the Monuments Men Foundation for the Preservation of Art, say it's not that simple and that the museum should turn over the painting to Emden's heirs. Here to discuss is Robert Elder, founder and chairman of the Monuments Men Foundation, and Thaddeus Stauber, legal counsel for the Museum of Fine Arts Houston. Gentlemen, good morning.
Morning.
Robert, let me start with you. What's the basis at this point for your contention that this painting was sold in 1938 by Max Emden to Hitler's art dealer under duress?
Well, that's no question. The German Advisory Commission in 2019, a group of scholars and jurists, including the equivalent of our Supreme Court justice and Speaker of the House, ruled that the three paintings that Max Emden sold to Adolf Hitler's art dealer, all three by Bellotto, were the consequence of loss of assets due to persecution. Put in plain language, the Nazis squeezed this German Jew and his businesses. They Aryanized his businesses, and he was forced to sell assets to raise money to pay bills with. And they had two of the three paintings that the Monuments Men found, all three paintings, at a salt mine in Altaussee. Two of the paintings were in Germany and were returned to the family in 2019. The third painting, the German Advisory Commission adjudicated, they thought at the time was lost. We now know, the Monuments Men Foundation determined that the painting in Houston is without question the third painting by Emden, and those are the circumstances.
Thaddeus, what's the museum's basis for contending Emden sold the painting voluntarily? Oh, looks like we have lost Thaddeus Stauber. We'll see if we can get him back on the line. In the meantime, Robert Elder.
It's Robert Edsel.
Edsel, excuse me. My apologies.
All right.
Why, when the Monuments Men recovered this painting at the end of World War II, did it not go back to the Emden family? Can you explain what happened
then? The Monuments Men were responsible for working with countries in Europe that had had their works of art looted. And the agreement with the various countries was that the Monuments Men would return them to the countries from which they'd been taken. And then within each country, it was their responsibility to determine who the rightful owners were. So these three paintings that had belonged to Emden that were acquired by Hitler's art dealer were part of literally millions of stolen cultural objects that the Monuments Men and women found and sorted through over a period of 6 years. In 1946, the Monuments Men received notification from the Netherlands that they were looking for a painting by Bellotto, marketplace at Pirna. Of course, there are multiple versions of this painting painted by Bellotto himself, an extraordinarily skilled artist. And they erroneously thought that one of these three paintings of Emden's was the painting that the Netherlands was looking for. They sent it back to the Netherlands, and they sent it to the Netherlands in 1946. In 1947-48, a German named Hugo Moser, who claimed he had a painting by Bellotto of the same name, and in fact, he did have a painting of the same name by someone who painted in the style of Bellotto, that he was looking for that. And he filed a claim with the Dutch government for his painting. And the Dutch government, confused, believed that the Emden painting that the Monuments Men had returned was actually his painting, and they gave it to him. He subsequently realized he had the wrong painting. In fact, he had a masterpiece by Bellotto, and he fraudulently removed labels from the back of the painting, fabricated a new provenance for the painting, and then sold it to a collector who later donated it to the museum. So that is the simple truth. The painting that Houston has, which they paid nothing for, they acquired as a consequence of a clerical error compounded by a fraud.
Thaddeus, Stauber's back on the line. Thaddeus, what's the museum's basis for contending Emden sold the painting voluntarily?
Thanks, Craig. The basis for that is the actual historical facts and the documents that we were able to find in 2007. This claim was first brought to the museum's attention by Mr. Emden's prior lawyers. At that time, as a young lawyer, I had been working with the former director, Peter Marzio, in helping the museum community put together the Washington Principles, which guide the research on how to determine whether there is a claim is meritorious or not. And Peter Marzio took the extraordinary step of saying, we need to be transparent. We're a public institution. We hold the paintings and our works here in trust as the stewards for the people of the city of Houston and the state of Texas. And he instructed me to travel to Europe and work with Laurie Stein, who's been honored by the German government for her work on behalf of provenance research throughout the years. And Lori and I uncovered the actual transactional documents from 1938 and the story of Mr. Max Emden. And what we discovered was that Mr. Emden had actually left Germany in the 20s when he sold most of his business interests, and he had located himself on a private island in Switzerland where he was living in a villa, and he had his artwork and his art collection and his wealth with him. As the war moved forward, there is no question that Mr. Emden's, some of his interests back in Germany were subject to some seizures and some duress, but his art collection and his ability to live his lifestyle continued on in Switzerland. He himself reached out to Anna Gaspari, who was his Jewish dealer, and instructed her to offer the three Bellottos. The three Bellottos were sent from Switzerland into Berlin, showed to Karl Haberstock, offered at a price that Mr. Emden set. When Karl Haberstock didn't move on him quickly enough, Mr. Emden called them back, had them come back through London, shown to other prospective buyers. Only later in 1938, then, did Mr. Emden decide to send the works back into Berlin after an agreed-upon price was reached and the funds were transferred to Mr. Emden. Mr. Emden continued to live his life on the private island. He died of natural causes in 1940, and his son inherited his estate, including his entire art collection, and was able to manage the estate and move on. After the war, remarkably, we also discovered that Mr. Emden's son had submitted some claims for property that was lost in Germany, but had made no claims to these particular artworks or any of the assets that Mr. Emden had outside of the United States. And that, unbelievably, was all the documentation we were able to uncover with respect to this. And we shared that. We shared that complete report. We shared the documentation with Mr. Emden's lawyers, and no claim was filed. That then brings us to now, to today. And what we told Mr. Emden when he reapproached us again now with new counsel and with the Monuments Men Foundation, that if there are facts that weigh on or historical documents that help inform the transaction in 1938, we will look at it anew and we'll look at it with fresh eyes. Gary Tinnerow, the current director, and the museum's board just did just that. And looking at it again, the facts have not changed from the 1938 transaction, and therefore on the merits, the claim was denied.
All right. I'm going to stop. I apologize for interrupting there, Thaddeus, but I want to get back to Robert Edsel in our very limited time remaining. Do you see, Robert, any room for compromise between Emden's heirs and the museum?
Sure. The museum can put its money where its mouth is and stop hoodwinking the system by arguing technical defenses in the courtroom and arguing the merits of the case in the court of public opinion. And they talk about Washington principles, but the Washington principles argue against using technical defenses. And what they did in 2007 is backed up by a provenance report, which is a sham. And I invite your listeners to go to the monumentsmenfoundation.org website, where we have copies of these documents. They don't have to listen to a 15-minute radio interview and imagine what they are. They can go there and read the reports for themselves and read our analysis of the reports. And I am quite confident that your listeners are skilled enough to understand what's taken place here and how wrong it is that the museum continues to search for a way to keep this painting when they know who it belongs to. There's no evidence Emden received payment. And that's, so there are the issues. The compromise is do the right thing, observe the moral arc of history here, and right a rightable wrong about World War II.
That's Robert Edsel, founder and chairman of the Monuments Men Foundation, and Thaddeus Stauber, legal counsel for the Museum of Fine Arts Houston. Gentlemen, thank you. And that'll do it for today's show. The Houston Matters team includes Michael Haggerty, Joshua Zinn, Troy Schultz, and William Menhivar. Jared Carroll's our technical director. On tomorrow's show, we'll have a special edition of the program, as it will be June 1st, the first official day of the Atlantic hurricane season. We will devote the hour to preparing for the season. We'll talk with Matt Rosenkranz, lead hurricane season forecaster for NOAA, about expectations for the next 6 months. Also, we'll offer a first-timer's guide to hurricane season, from what watches and warnings things mean to how much time you typically have to prepare, when to leave and when to stay, which areas of Houston tend to flood the most and why. We'll also visit Harris County's Emergency Operations Center and Houston Transtar, and we'll go shopping for hurricane season supplies. I'm Craig Cohen. Join us tomorrow for that special edition of Houston Matters.
Houston Public Media.